Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, and welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. You know, I was thinking about this, the holidays, you know, sort of forget about gardening. You've got all these things to take care of, and boy, once the holidays are over, then you start thinking, oh man, it's a long time before we can get outdoors and dig in the dirt again. But lucky for us, our guest today is going to help you and me get a whole bunch of seeds started indoors. Again, Larry Mueller here. Welcome to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Our guest, Sharon Morrissey, is the UW Extension Consumer Horticulture Agent for Milwaukee County. And Sharon, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Always fun to talk with you. And we're definitely still in the throes of winter, and we're going to be that way for weeks, but it's a great time to think about starting seeds indoors. We had some questions about it last week on the show, and I said, you know what? We got an expert coming to talk about it this week, and here you are. What are the benefits of starting seeds?
Well, I guess selection is probably the biggest one. You can choose from the myriad varieties of seeds of vegetables and flowers that are offered to you through the seed catalogs that keep coming to your mailbox every year when you start from seeds yourself. If you purchase plants, transplants from local retail centers, you still have a good variety, but you won't necessarily have a selection of 1,500 different tomatoes to choose from.
For example.
Or you might have a couple hundred cucumber types that you can do, or different squashes, and think of all those different forms of lettuce that you may not be able to find seeds for in your local retail centers. So that selection is, I think, part of what drives people to do it. And another part is cost. It is maybe less expensive, but then again, maybe not. You do have to put the money into the supplies to have the containers in order to start seeds, to have the sterile seed starting mix to start seeds. You do need to provide light. Bottom heat is important, and that probably is best done through heat mats that are an expensive initial purchase, but over time they certainly pay off. So it's kind of a combination, but I think selection, and then also that challenge of being able to start your own seeds and take a plant from seedling and into the garden all the way through harvest. It's so rewarding, and it is a challenge. Starting seeds is not a no-brainer, as they say. There's a lot more to it than you may think if you've never tried it before.
And, you know, some of the crops that we grow require a fairly long growing season that makes starting seeds or maybe buying the plants later important.
Yes, we have a limited growing season, days to maturity, something like 120 maybe, 130, and depending on our spring weather, either it may be too cold to put seeds into the ground very early, or we may have a late frost that kills off young seedlings if you're planting the wrong things and getting them out there too early. And you also may have the issue of wet soils, not being able to work the soil and get out there to plant the seeds because the soil's too wet. So there are a lot of restrictions that kind of may shorten our growing season. So you do need to start a lot of our plants indoors.
Yeah, which crops would you recommend starting for sure with that kind of late growing season or longer growing season in mind?
Well, definitely tomatoes, peppers, eggplants. They take probably the longest. They're some of the very first things to start indoors. However, I think kind of tradition that's passed along sometimes dictates planting them earlier indoors than you really need to. And the drawback to that is that the longer you have to keep them thriving indoors under artificial lights and with the temperatures that you need to control, the more difficult it is to have a really bushy, thick, vigorous plant to put out into the garden. So you're trying to start those seedlings at the exact right time so you don't have to keep them growing too long indoors, but you still have enough time to get them to a stage where they transplant well and then take off when they're in the ground.
Yeah. And for how do we determine? I mean, I'm sure Extension has some publications or some things online that tell us best times typically to start things like tomatoes.
There is a good publication through Extension called The Vegetable Garden. I believe it's the A1989 is the number on it, I think, and it's available through our publication's website. In the back of that publication, there is an alphabetical listing of the major vegetable crops and the dates which they should be started indoors, if you're doing that, and the dates that they can be planted outside, whether you're starting from seed or transplants, and all that information is there in an alphabetical order. I also took that information and put it into chronological order in a fact sheet, and that's available on the Milwaukee County UW Extension website on our horticulture page. And some people find that a little more helpful because it goes through chronologically. And I adapted the timing for the Milwaukee area, but you can just subtract a couple of weeks from that for Dane County. Mm-hmm. And then as you go farther north, of course, you'll have to add a couple of weeks to it. But it does tell you what to start indoors at the very beginning, then when those plants can go outside and which seeds can be planted directly into the soil at what time. And I think it's a little more helpful to people being in chronological order, date order.
Yeah, that's great. And again, where do we go for that?
The Milwaukee County UW Extension website, and that is simply the word Milwaukee spelled out, .uwex.edu, and it's on the horticulture page there.
Oh, that's wonderful. What's the best medium to start seeds in your mind?
I think any purchased seed starting mix is your best bet. It is a little bit more of an expense than putting your own together, but there are so many qualities that a seed starting mix need to have to make it successful that are hard to do by making your own mix. One of the most important thing is it needs to be sterile. Seed starting mix needs to be sterile. And when you purchase the individual components, those may not be sterile. And the threat is of the damping off fungi that seedlings are so susceptible to. There's also the issue of that combination of moist, well-drained, having good airspace and enough airspace, but not so much airspace that the seedlings, those tiny roots, dry out, but also not so much moisture holding that it stays too wet and they rot and the fungus can develop. So I think a purchased seed starting mix is your best bet.
And do you like the small peat pellets, or is it better just to start with a larger container right away?
I think it depends on what you're starting. You can start with small containers and the cell packs and putting one seed per cell or as close to one seed as you can get. Anytime you're working with the cucurbits, which are all of the vine crops, including cucumbers and all the squashes, the melons, they have very brittle roots. They really can be easily damaged and take a little while to get established because of those brittle roots when you transplant them. So by starting them in peat pellets or peat pots, you don't need to remove them from a pot. You don't need to disturb the roots when you plant them. You simply put the entire thing into the ground. If you're using peat pots, you have to make sure that any of the peat fiber that's sticking above the ground from the pot is torn off and covered up so that that doesn't wick water away from the root system. But it does help to protect the roots. So it really depends on what you're planting.
You know, as you were talking, I thought back to the first time that I started tomatoes indoor from seed. And I was so proud of myself. I had these wonderful-looking tomato plants. And I set them out, and the next morning I went out and looked, and they were all completely white. The chlorophyll was completely gone because I hadn't sort of harden them off.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's a process that's critical.
Oh, I was so disgusted with myself.
And that's so devastating when you've put so much time into getting them started indoors. And that hardening off process should take a good week. They say 2 weeks, ideally. And that is a process that exposes those seedlings to more and more of those environmental conditions they'll encounter in the garden. Sun, wind, and changes in temperature.
Well, that was a mistake I didn't make a second time.
Yeah. And people ask about that when they're purchasing seedlings, too, and for transplant, small plants for transplant. And I urge people to kind of look at the conditions under which those plants they're purchasing are staged at the retail center where they're purchasing them. So if it's an area that's an enclosed greenhouse setting, even if it's a poly house covering that's protecting them for the early season, those will need to be hardened off before you bring them out and put them into the garden. On the other hand, if they are staged on benches out in the open, maybe have a little shade cloth over the top of it, but they have the air movement, they've been exposed to some cold temperatures, then the hardening off process doesn't need to take quite as long.
Those are very, very good points. I want to give our listeners a chance to join in. You can call in with your questions or comments. What did well in your garden this year? Maybe talk about that. What about starting seeds indoors, lighting? We can talk about a whole bunch of things with our guest, pretty much the whole gamut when it comes to the garden. And Sharon Morrissey, our UW Extension Consumer Horticulture Agent for Milwaukee County. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can also post on our Facebook page, go to the Larry Mueller Show title for that page, and email us at talk@wpr.org. Let's turn to Jim in Waukegan, Illinois, next. Jim, hi.
Good
thanks.
Morning, yeah. Good morning. I'm interested in growing leaf lettuce, and I wonder how that would start indoors. I'm leaning toward just growing the seeds outdoors. But most importantly, I was wondering if Sharon could comment on some specific varieties of green and red leaf lettuce that would do well in northeast Illinois or southeast Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm. Oh, certainly, yes. And all of those varieties of leaf lettuces have become so popular, you don't go to any restaurant anymore and find just green lettuce in your salad.
No.
So many options for different colors and flavors, and they are very easy to grow indoors and outdoors. This is something, these leaf lettuces and many of the microgreens are things that you can grow on a windowsill indoors in a shallow tray with a little bit of soil, because the younger they are when you harvest them by just cutting them off at the soil line, the more tender and tasty they are. Starting seed outdoors for leaf lettuce is probably the best way to go, and you can start those seeds in the Milwaukee area around the third week of April or earlier, depending on what our spring weather is like. But they are very tolerant of cool soils and cold air temperatures. They can even tolerate a light frost. So starting them outdoors is probably the best way to do it. They would be difficult to transplant. But I get, you can do that. You would just need to grow them up to be a little bit larger before you put them into the ground. Transplants that you start from seed indoors are good for the head lettuces, like the romaine cost-type lettuces, the butter crunch lettuce, and the iceberg lettuces. Those are best done as individual plants, and that they work great if you start them early, because our growing season gets so hot so quickly, and the heat always makes lettuce become bitter. As far as varieties, what you're looking for, because of that heat that arrives way too early for us, for our crops like lettuce, you're looking for varieties that are bolt-resistant or slow to bolt. And for red leaf lettuces, I know Red Sales is one that has been an All-America Selection winner many years ago and is recommended because of its tolerance to warmer weather. So that's one. There's for the green leaf lettuces, I think, for my money, the black-seeded Simpson. It's an old standard, but it performs beautifully every single year. And you try all kinds of them, and you know, you can hardly fail with any of them because they are so easy to grow. And it's just a matter of getting them in the ground and harvesting and being able to use them before it gets too hot.
Mm-hmm. Those black-seeded Simpson, they've been around forever, and they,
yeah.
you're right. It really is a good lettuce.
Yes, I've tried so many different varieties, and I always kind of make sure I have some black-seeded Simpson because I know it will perform well. The other one that's related to that is Simpson Elite, and it has been selected for its heat tolerance. And I haven't necessarily experienced that myself, but that is what is it's advertised as. And I have talked to gardeners who say it is a little bit more heat tolerant.
There we go. Jim, thank you so much. Appreciate your call. Let's turn to Steve in Sauk County. Well, Steve, we'll get to you in just a minute. A reminder here that you're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. My guest today, Sharon Morrissey, UW Extension Consumer Horticulture Agent for Milwaukee County. Cheryl Gasser, our on-air producer. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Just to let you know, coming up next week on Garden Talk, Laura Jull and Brian Huddleston will be with us. They'll talk about care for woody ornamentals and also for preventing, detecting, and addressing some garden diseases. So that's next week on Garden Talk. Right now, having a lot of fun talking with our UW Extension Horticulture Agent for Milwaukee, Sharon Morrissey. Again, you can join us at 800-642-1234 or go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show and post questions or comments there. Hey, and if you've got a nice garden photo, I'd love to see that too. Put that up on our Facebook page. And Sharon, we're going to go to Steve in Sauk County next. Steve, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, good morning to both of you. So I have started seeds for years and years and years under big full spectrum grow lights, and I've been seeing these changed over LED monstrosities, which are rather expensive. On the other hand, they claim remarkable results, and I'm wondering whether you A, have any insights or experience with them, and B, whether you know whether they basically are used the same way. In other words, you just jam them down as deep as you can without getting right on the plant, and then you raise them as the plant grows.
Boy, this is one I'm going to have to say I'm sorry, but I'm not familiar with them. I don't have any experience with them, and I'm not familiar with what spectrum of light they provide. And it is all about the spectrum of light and the intensity of the light, and that is the reason that you need to have other forms of lighting right up against the canopy of the leaves. Not touching them, but as low as you can get them, within 4 inches of the canopy is what they say. So I guess I'd like to hear from any of our listeners who have had experience with the LEDs.
Yeah, with starting them indoors. I have LEDs on an indoor rosemary plant and also on my lime tree. And they've works very well, but that, of course, is different from starting seeds indoors.
Yeah, I don't know what the spectrum is, as I say. You know, that LEDs last forever, and, they cost a lot less to run. So they it would be great if that was a viable option for seed starting.
So, okay, well, thank you very much.
Yeah, so if you want to experiment, Steve, spend a few bucks, more than a couple of bucks. We'd love to hear the results. Maybe somebody else has tried it. And I know the earliest ones, sort of general news that people had said to me, the earliest ones didn't work well, but the newest ones are working pretty well. So, but that's, I don't see any research to back that up, so I guess we're just going to have to experiment. Jerry in Milwaukee, hi, thanks for calling.
Good morning. I had a couple of questions. I've got an asparagus patch in the northern part of the state of Wisconsin. I'm pretty sure it's a good 25 years old. My father planted it, and it's pretty productive year after year. I was just wondering two things. I've overheard some people talk about life expectancy of asparagus, that some strains or maybe many different species only last 15 years or so. And secondly, I was wondering, let's say in the fall or in between growing seasons, is there anything I can do to the patch. Usually I just let it fern out, and then I leave the vegetation there, and it sits all winter. And sometimes I try burning it off in the spring, but I was wondering, should I maybe be cutting it down in the fall or something to that effect?
Thank you. Cutting it down in the fall is the recommendation, and part of that is for disease and insect control, and then try to remove that from your property if you can, or burn that material because there can be eggs from the asparagus beetles. There's two different kinds of asparagus beetles, and there's also a rust that attacks asparagus, and removing that foliage from the asparagus patch can be very helpful in preventing that disease or controlling it if you have had problems with it. So that is a recommendation, to take them down in the fall. Wait till they turn that glorious yellow that they turn, and then cut them down. And then you're all ready to go for the spring. And as far as life expectancy, 15 to 30 years maybe. And if the patch is still producing well, then it's doing okay, continue with it. And especially if you're not seeing any diseases. But you can expect an asparagus patch to go for a good 20 years or so. What happens is that those crowns get so large, and when they're planted maybe a foot apart, and they have very thick roots that get larger and tougher as the years go on. And they also start to come up out of the ground, and in fact, many people like to put an additional couple inches of soil on top of their asparagus patch or compost, or composted manure, on top of their patch in the spring. And that helps to cover those crowns a little more, give them a little more ground to grow some new roots in. And I think that's what determines the life expectancy, is how much they've come out of the soil and how large those roots have gotten. But as long as it's producing well, don't mess with success.
No.
I've heard people say that they run across it out in the forest just growing by itself, and I'm just wondering, maybe is it possible that stuff is very old or not very old?
The wild asparagus.
Yeah, the wild asparagus.
Yeah.
They get along the roadsides a lot of times. And I really don't know if it's very old. It certainly travels by bird and through seed that birds eat from an asparagus patch. So I don't know how old those are.
But they can be, they've got to be pretty old, some of them at least.
Yeah. There's nothing that will stop them from growing unless there's too much competition from other plants around them. They do say that, weedy asparagus patches should be managed so that the weeds are controlled, and so you're not competing with the asparagus for the nutrients and water and space. So that would be happening along a roadside, so they may not have as long a life expectancy because of that.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks, Jer. For calling. Appreciate it. Judy in Grafton, it's your turn. Hi, Judy.
Hi. I just wanted to ask Sharon if she's done any of this winter sowing where you take a milk jug, cut it in half, and put soil in the bottom half, and then plant cold weather crops or plants like zinnias that seed themselves, put them in there, and then put the cover on and set them out in like late February, early March. I've done this for a couple years.
Really?
It works so cool. And I work at a care center. They love watching them because the plants that come up in spring when they're ready, and they are usually very sturdy plants. Actually, if you want to know more about it, just Google winter sowing, S-O-W-I-N-G, of course, and there's a whole directions on how to do it. I just happened across it and have done it now for 2 years, and it's really neat.
And so you use a plastic milk jug, a gallon milk jug?
And right. Cut
it in bottom half. Off of it, cut it in half.
Well, not all together. You leave a hinge by the handle.
Okay.
And then you cover it when you've got your seeds, your dirt and seeds in there, and then you put masking tape not all around, and you set them out so that in the spring when it rains, you don't put the cover on the top so that the rain can get into the jug.
The hole is the cap.
It's amazing. I did spinach, lettuce, kale.
Wow.
And sunflowers, and they just come up just great.
Well, that sounds wonderful. You're kind of mimicking the natural process of plants refeeding. So they get their cold period that they need, and then they come up, and yet they're protected because of the soil. Do you put any kind of mulch over or around these containers?
I didn't, but I set them in the snow.
Bare ground.
So they had that protection of the snow. But, flowers, you know, a kind of flower that will recede, like cosmos and zinnias, that all works.
Wow.
So then you have a jug of soil with seedlings, and then you can separate out the seedlings and transplant those directly into
right.
the ground?
Yeah, and come when on warm days, I open them up and let the sun shine in a little bit more and keep them kind of in the shade because they're tender. But, it works really cool. I just happened across it. So I just wanted to share that.
Yeah, I wonder if any of those other, takeout food containers and those big tubs that you get the mixed lettuces and spinach in, if those would work.
I wonder.
Or like rotisserie chicken containers, you know, where you've got a dome.
It might, but you know what? I think it's important to have it be opaque.
Oh, the opaque, yeah.
Yeah, I think the milk jug is not so clear, and the bright sun wouldn't burn it as much.
And also you have the cap on top of the milk jug that you can take off and put back on to control temperature and humidity a little bit.
You do, but I usually leave the cap off.
Off completely.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is an awful lot.
Snow or rain can get in.
Yeah.
Well, it certainly is a lot like a cold frame. And
it's
just mini on a miniature scale. So that's interesting. I'll have to check out that website. And I'm sure there are some years where it may not be as effective depending on what the weather ends up being like. If it's too cold and the seeds, if you have a warm spell and then it gets really cold, you could have problems.
Yeah.
What was that website again?
Winter Sowing, WinterSowing.
Winter Sowing. We'll try and put that up on our Facebook page, too, at the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page.
Yeah, there's details, real good details on how to do it. But I've done it now for 2 years, and even last year with that bitter cold winter, it worked.
Oh.
Gosh, I'm going to go home and try it.
Let
me give you a little, people, just listeners in general, a little bit of a tip about Googling for information. And I don't know if this has been talked about before on the show or not, but what I always do, and we encourage all of our Master Gardener volunteers to do, is when you Google a topic, if after that topic you put site:edu, then all of the websites that come up will be educational. They will be from universities. They will be from extension services all over the country. And Google usually sorts those somewhat by region and locale. So you really are assured of getting information. If there's research-based information out there, if there is research that has gone on, if there are recommendations that an extension service somewhere in the country is making, it will show up, and you don't have to weed through all of the other things that may not be as reliable.
Hit a colon, and then
you start with your topic.
Yep.
And then site:edu.
.edu. Okay. All right.
Okay.
Very good points. Thank you, Judy. Appreciate the call very much. Carolyn Dousman, it's your turn. Hi, Carol.
Good morning. Hi, how are you?
Wonderful. Thank you for calling. What can we do for you today?
I just have two quick questions. One is, I grow begonias. I live in the middle of a very mature oak woods, and my begonias turn out beautiful every year. In fact, they almost get tree-like. I bring my bulbs in every fall. I do have great success with most. Some don't make it, and I'm wondering what I'm doing wrong. My second question, how do I start a patient's seeds indoors? They're tough.
They certainly are tough. And if somebody were to ask me, what is the flower seed that we would plant earliest in the year, in the spring, before, as indoors, you're starting these seeds, it would be in patience. They take forever to form a plant. So I really appreciate what the growers are able to do, control and that control of the environment they need to have to grow in patience indoors. And I think this is a thing where you have to just be so diligent for such a very long period of time. And I don't know if they need to have the seed covered or not. Probably not, because they are such tiny seeds. They're like little grains of pepper. And so it is difficult to sow them and not cover them too deeply and then control the moisture and the air space in the soil, in the medium, and controlling the air temperature. And you have to do that from January all the way through, well, Memorial Day, because we really aren't supposed to sow until then.
Is bottom heat very important on those also?
The bottom heat's pretty important on most seeds. So when you start seeds, a good warm soil at about 70 degrees is pretty much the general rule for seed starting indoors. And that warm soil temperature with cool air temperatures is the combination that will get you good growth without it being too lush, and the stems will be thicker and stronger and denser. The plants will stay bushier because of the cooler air temperatures, and the warm soil temperature will encourage good root growth. So I can't give you any more pointers than that on impatience. It's just a long time that you got to take care of them.
And begonias?
And as far as the begonias, you said you bring your bulbs in every year, so you're talking about the tuberous begonias, I'm assuming.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, with those, they are a pretty succulent tuber, and so they can't be stored in anything that's very moist, and controlling that moisture is important. I believe the recommendation with begonias and many of those other tender bulbs that you bring indoors, whether it's a rhizome or a tuber or a bulb, is to put them into a medium that is extremely well-drained but holds some humidity around them in a plastic bag that is perforated. So you have air exchange, but you're not going to cause them to rot. And that humidity is important to keep them from totally drying out and shriveling. And you need to check them frequently to find any of them that are starting to rot, because once those fungi move in, it can take over all of the tubers that you have stored.
Oh, that's good to know. Okay.
And if you're starting to see any of the rot, if it's just on the surface, then I would open up the bags. I would maybe take them all out and replenish the sphagnum peat or whatever you're using. And sphagnum is very good to use for that, because it is a moisture holding but very, very airy.
Yeah, I usually use like sawdust.
Sawdust.
So I don't know if that makes a difference.
You usually use what?
Sawdust.
Sawdust.
Oh, okay. Well, that would be denser. Yeah. And would hold more moisture for a longer period of time without as much air circulation.
Okay.
So that might not be a good thing.
Yeah. Yeah, that may be something you could change and have better success.
Mm-hmm. And thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Oh, my goodness, we have some open lines. Our guest today, Sharon Morrissey, UW Extension Consumer Horticulture Agent for Milwaukee County. Join in. Open lines get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@WPR.org or go to our Facebook page. Our Facebook page title is The Larry Mueller Show, and we'd certainly love to hear from you.
Maybe they all ran out to start sowing some seeds and doing some winter sowing.
I know.
Such a good idea.
It's a wonderful, I love that idea. So I hope we get some comments from folks about how it's working. That link for winter sowing is now up on our Facebook page. The website is winter-sown-dot-org. There you go. .org. I should say .org, not hyphen. So it's winter-sown-dot-org. There we go. It's up on our Facebook page.
Okay.
We have Tom and Prairie du Chien wanted to kind of nail you down a little bit. When is the best time to plant tomatoes from seed, and what kind of soil is best as a seed starter? And we did talk a little bit about that, but worth repeating.
Yeah, with starting seeds, I do recommend the purchased, bagged, prepared sterile seed starting mixes that you can purchase at garden centers. And for tomatoes, you start the mid to late April. And I've heard many people say that their parents always started their seeds, their tomato seeds, on St. Patrick's Day. And that's like about a month too early. It's a month earlier than you need to. It certainly isn't going to hurt to do that, but as I mentioned earlier, if you start them indoors too early, then you've just got to take care of them and keep them in good condition longer. So wait till mid to late April. Now, this is for the Milwaukee area, and it's all based on that 50% frost-free date. And the 50% frost-free date in the Milwaukee area is around the 1st of May.
Damn.
So go back about 6 weeks from that 50% frost-free date for your area.
There we go.
I mean, I'm sorry, 6 weeks. It's not
6 weeks.
It's about 4 weeks.
4 weeks. Okay. Mm-hmm. There we go. Dot in Manitowoc. Thanks a lot for calling. Hi.
And my question is, when the seed package says 60 or 90 days, when does that start, that number start? When you plant the seed or when the seedling emerges from the soil, when is that number important? Or, for instance, tomatoes, too. They'll say X amount of days. When does that day start?
Mm-hmm.
Generally, it starts from the date of transplant of the plant or when the seedling has emerged.
Okay.
They don't really take into account how long it takes for that seed to germinate and emerge. So, and if you're starting plants indoors, it generally goes from when you transplant that out into the ground.
Oh, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Dot.
Yeah, it's a good question. You wonder about that. You do.
You know,
some things like carrots take 14 days to emerge. And so do you count that 14 days in the 60 it takes to produce them? No. You don't.
And that, you know, I think that's the first time we've ever had that question.
Yeah.
That's a great question, Dot. Thanks. Mary in Dunville, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I have a comment, and it's a technique that I use to grow tomatoes. I remove the bottom of a 5-gallon bucket. I dig up the soil, and then I place the bucket on top, put about 3/4 of it full with medium. I use, like, manure in potting soil, and then I put my transplants in there that I grew. You put the covers on, and you can sort of control the wind. If you get hail, you just put the covers back on the bucket. And I've had, 12-foot tomatoes grow out of that.
Huh. Oh, my goodness. And so you leave the bottom of the bucket. You take the bottom of the bucket off so that
Water sufficiently, it'll go down and drive those big ruts right down in the ground.
And then when do you take the bucket away?
I don't.
Oh, you just leave that there?
I just leave it there so I have no dirt splashing up bacteria on the plants.
Uh-huh.
Wow.
I use a plastic piece of conduit, and I line the buckets up and then put a piece of conduit in one bucket to the next bucket, and that's what I tie my tomatoes up with. They withstood tornadoes.
So that's your support system for them.
Works well. For
wow.
Me. Well, interesting. Gardeners are the most resourceful and creative people I have ever run across in any field. It's
and I'm in
amazing.
A wheelchair now. So that's I've been gardening since I was like 4 years old. But I had to develop a new way to do things.
Wow.
So I can get up to it with my chair.
Oh, nice.
I can tie it up.
Yeah.
Wow. That is wonderful, Mary.
Sounds like a good plan. And, you know, with tomatoes, you could either let them sprawl in the ground or you can stake them up and kind of vine them up a stake, or you can cage them or some sort of combination of that. But, you know, I really find that probably vining them a little more densely than just a single vine, allowing more than one stem to continue to grow, is probably one of the better ways to do it. The cages, I know, are convenient and easy, and a lot of people use cages, but you also hold in a lot more moisture around the leaves of the tomato, and that moisture and humidity around the leaves is what really encourages all those leaf spot diseases that can just be killers for tomato plants.
Yeah.
So if you're going to use the cages, it's important to prune out some branches, prune out some additional leaves so that you get a better air circulation. Or use cages that are as large as you can accommodate. They are making larger cages now, the square cages that fold down for storage.
Mm-hmm.
They're making those almost twice as wide in diameter as they were previously because it's so helpful to have that extra space to allow the air to circulate. So, yeah, you do have to have some sort of support system. And letting them sprawl is usually not very successful. They sit on the ground, even if they're sitting on straw. And I find that you end up with mice getting and slugs getting more of them than you do.
Yeah.
You hardly have an undamaged tomato if you don't do something to support them.
We have an active chipmunk that comes in, and he'll just take a bite out of each tomato if we don't stake them up.
But Mary, if you ever have a photo of your system.
Oh, yeah. Oh sure. I have all kinds of systems.
Well, I tell you what, if you have a chance, send the photo or photos into our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show.
Sure.
Because I know other gardeners would like to see it, too.
Sure. Okay. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Mary. You're right, Sharon. Well, gardeners are ingenious a lot of time.
They are. And, you know, people who have that bent of their nature toward sort of engineering things, they find ways to be very, very precise about it. And others can take sticks and broom handles and leftover vines to tie things up and, you know, all kinds of found items to put things together to make things work. And it's all the same principle, just how you execute it.
Yeah.
We all find what works for us.
Sharon Morrissey, UW Extension Consumer Horticulture Agent for Milwaukee County. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. So happy to have you listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. On this edition of Garden Talk, visiting with Sharon Morrissey, UW Extension Consumer Horticulture Agent for Milwaukee County. You can join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Go to our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. You can post a question, comment, or photo there. I love the photos. Or email us at talk@wpr.org. Rosemary in Fountain City up next. Hi, Rosemary.
Hi. And I have a question. This is a question for you, Larry.
Uh-huh.
For years, I've been trying to grow a rosemary plant, and I've brought mine in the fall, and it always dies. Somebody said, well, you have to start with a new plant. Don't bring an old one in. So I bought a new one this year, put it in a southern window, and it still died. One said mist it regularly. I've tried that, and it did not work. What am I doing wrong?
Well, mine is pretty good size, and it's like two years old at least. It's the end of the third year. And I'll tell you what, it grows right next to limey, the lime tree, and they're outside all summer and into the fall, and I, you know, just watering them once a week usually. And I bring them in the winter, and they sit in a south-facing window. Limey gets a lot of extra light, and rosemary doesn't get any. And rosemary, I don't know why it grows so well, but it just literally is.
So it doesn't get the dirt then.
It doesn't what?
It doesn't get direct light. Is that what you're saying?
It gets direct light all summer. And
yes, but I mean when you bring it in the winter.
No, it might get a little. I mean, it's a little too far away from the grow lights for, you know, it's probably 4 or 5 feet from the grow light. So it's not going to get anything from the grow light, but it's right in front of the window.
And oh, it is right in front.
Right in front of the window, and it's a south-facing window. And there's not, it gets really good sun. There's no tree we lost the tree in our backyard, which blocked all of the sun. And now it gets just direct sun through. Well, actually, not direct, but directly through the window. It gets a lot of winter sun. And it, I just looked at, looking at it this morning, I thought, boy, that looks healthy.
Wow.
And I put a little, I also have, I put a little fertilizer in the pot, and Sharon might say, why are you doing that? But I have some some sort of fish emulsion that's like a 7-1-1, 7%, 1%, 1% N, P, and K. Mm-hmm. And I put that in probably every other week.
Every other.
About a tablespoon.
Well, I'll give it a try again next winter.
And maybe it's that fish emulsion that you can buy.
Maybe.
It comes in a white bottle, or a white plastic bottle, and I just dump a little in the water every time I water.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
And
so much.
Thanks, and Rosemary Wanting to Grow Rosemary. All right.
Right, that's right. Okay. Bye.
Bye. Sharon, did I make any sense? It just seems to work for me.
Yeah, I've heard from many an experienced and very good gardener that they have a hard time growing rosemary indoors. So rosemary should not despair. It's not necessarily her. And Larry, hearing about your planting, I'm thinking it might have a little to do with its maturity as well. Now, once a plant is a little bit older and larger, that it will succeed a little easier indoors than when it's very, very young. But it is a matter of humidity. You think about their normal environment, and they need to have some humidity, and that's something very hard to do for houseplants because we live in such dry homes, as we are all experiencing right now, with our skin drying out and our lips and our mouths and our noses and everything. And so they do need pretty high humidity. And I've always heard that that's the real limiting factor with growing rosemary indoors.
That may be the issue at my place, because at our home, it's in my bedroom. The plants are in the bedroom, actually. And the bathroom is right kind of next door. And so, you're showering every single day. So maybe there's a little more. And I don't notice the dryness in that bedroom very much.
That could well be it.
Yeah, could well be it.
And, for adding humidity to the air surrounding houseplants, you often hear these recommendations of a tray of pebbles with water in it or misting them. Neither of those are really very effective. The least effective is misting. That lasts for about as long as it takes you to spray the mist. And then it's gone. It just gets absorbed so quickly into the air, especially during the wintertime, like we have the cooler temperatures indoors and such. And the tray of pebbles, you've got to make sure that you keep that filled, and you don't want the plants to be sitting close enough to be able to soak any of that water back up. It's very problematic to provide a lot of humidity for plants. A humidifier right next to the or a vaporizer, next to the plants is probably the best way to do it, but you have to watch it. You don't want too much humidity, you'll rot the leaves.
Yeah.
So it's a fine line.
Renee in Green Bay has something for us. Hi, Renee. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Hey, everybody, thanks for all your information, and especially the winter sowing. I'm going to do that on my balcony.
Okay.
And, I'm just a newbie, so everybody giggle. I'm trying to figure out how to sprout an avocado pit. I keep throwing these away, and right now I have it in a little plastic Dixie cup from Jell-O in water, and it's cracked, and it's not sprouting yet. There's a little thing on. I was just wondering, should I keep that in the light, and when do I put it in soil? I'm a newbie. This is the first time I've ever done anything indoors.
Yeah, that's a good question. In England, they have a pit society. And it's a whole group of people who take pits from various food, fruits and stuff, and grow them indoors. So an avocado pit is one that people have been doing for years, and sometimes successfully and sometimes not. It does seem to be a little bit random. You don't get 100% germination. Not every pit is going to actually develop the shoot and the root from the pit that you want. And even if it's cracked open, it may not do it. A typical way to do to start an avocado from a pit is to stick toothpicks in it in maybe three places about halfway up the bulb and then let those rest on the edges of a jar or something that you can keep water in so the base of it is always in water, only about halfway up at the pit. So if you're in a small Jello container, I'm wondering if maybe you don't have enough moisture for it continuously as it needs. But then again, like I say, it's kind of iffy. Not all of them will germinate and form one. So just keep trying. Maybe change it up to a jar and use these toothpicks to support it so it's only half in the water and see what happens with it.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, thank you. I have a friend who only grows avocados, and every plant she has looks different. And I don't know if it's just her, a miracle. So that's what made me want to do this.
Yeah, well, there's different varieties of avocados. I don't know that for sure, but there may be different varieties of avocado plants. So they may have some differences in leaf. And also, they're very hard to get them to branch. That's the other problem that is really consistent with them. So you'll have this big, long spike, this big, long stem, but it'll never branch. So that can be a challenge. And
I have never gotten one to branch.
Yeah, it is very uncommon, I should say, to get it to branch. So.
Well, it's extinct when it comes to me.
Well, I also
have a nice day.
Yeah, Renee, thank you so much for calling. Do you ever try that? I haven't done it now for a little while, but they're kind of fun thing to do.
I don't think I've done it since the 70s. But
oh, my gosh. Well, I've done it since then.
Since then, huh? I did do a sweet potato one time that grew vines just beautifully, and they, like, circled the room, and it was just the coolest thing. That's another one that's kind of fun to do indoors with kids especially.
Yeah, absolutely. Sharon Morrissey, our guest today, the University of Wisconsin Extension Consumer Horticulture Agent for Milwaukee County. She's always a great guest and always great to have her on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Gardening can be a lot of fun and a rewarding thing to do, and as is true for many things in life, good information and skills is going to get you better results pretty often. Larry Mueller here, glad to have you along for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network as we visit with Sharon Morrissey, UW Extension Consumer Horticulture Agent for Milwaukee County. She knows so much about successfully growing vegetables, flowers, fruits, and a whole lot more. And Sharon, again, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. Appreciate it very much. And, you know, oh, we got her. Are you there, Sharon? Let's see. Oh, there. Now I think I lost you for a minute.
Oh, no.
And it was my fault.
Oh, no. Phew, wasn't me.
Oh, no, it wasn't you at all. So I'm glad you're here and I'm glad to have you back. And we have callers online. Let me give the number again. It's 1-800-642-1234. And, you know, Lori in Gladstone, Michigan has been waiting a long time. So let's get to her right now. Lori, hi. Thank you for waiting.
Hi. Thank you. That's fine. I have not had great luck in the past starting seeds. But I want to try it again this year. For Christmas, I received I could best describe it as kind of a miniature greenhouse that we have a big bay window that faces south. And I'm wondering if that would work for starting seeds, or would I still need supplemental light, et cetera?
You probably will need supplemental light.
Okay.
And with the greenhouse, if it is enclosed,
it's adjustable. You can open and close, but it's all covered, you know, of course, like in plastic. And
okay. Oh, is it like a two-shelf thing? It's like metal poles, and then
it has glass
that goes over it. Those are so cool. They're very nice.
Yeah.
I'm excited about it, but I was hoping I could start seeds in it, but also just to keep plants in it. It's pretty nice.
The thing you have to be careful with those is that the heat can build up inside of them. So even right. though you have the plastic and you can vent it and open and close mm-hmm. it, just you have to be really aware of that. And as far okay. as starting seeds in there, you probably will still need supplemental lighting because the light that actually gets through the windows, pretty much no matter what kind of windows you have, it's really pretty minimal. It seems like it's really, really, really funny, but it is not as much as you would get from having light bulbs over the canopy of the plants within 4 inches of the canopy.
Okay.
And the lights that they are probably best. And I was doing a little looking into those LED lights while we were on the break, and it sounds like they have the spectrum of light that people need for starting seeds, but they're still relatively expensive, even though they're inexpensive to operate. And so, the best recommendation, kind of the old tried and true, is one warm white and one cool white fluorescent light in a fixture. So if you can suspend that from the shelves, the problem will be that once the seedlings start to emerge, the light has to be real close to those, but then right. the light has to move up as the plants move up, as the seedlings grow and get taller.
Right.
So unfortunately, I really, if the things that don't take very long to germinate, those last things that you can start indoors and you only have them in there for about 4 weeks at max, might be able to be done there. And that would include all of the cucurbits, probably, so cucumbers and zucchinis and squashes and hard-rinded squashes and pumpkin melons. You could probably do those in a sunny southern window because you don't have them indoors for very long. And you would sow seeds indoors for those things in early May because you can transplant them outdoors in late May. Depending on how far north you are in Michigan, it'd be a little
late May is maybe pushing it. I usually wait till after Memorial Day here.
Okay.
We often get a frost, or even sometimes the first week in June. It's
not really? Okay.
Common.
So you must be a ways north in Michigan.
Well, we're in the Upper Peninsula.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, that's a ways north in Michigan. Yeah. So if you can add some supplemental lighting, I think you'll be more successful.
Okay, well, great. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Open lines. We'll get you on right away. We had Tracy emailing, and again, this is you kind of covered this already, but can you talk a little bit more about seeds that require light to grow versus to germinate versus
right.
no light to germinate, additional
right.
light, I should say, probably.
There's two aspects to that. Most seeds, when you sow the seeds, they can't be covered very deeply because they do need to have some light to germinate. Some seeds shouldn't be covered at all to germinate. And, the more shallowly they're sown, the more light will penetrate to them. So that's one aspect of light and seed germination. And then the other aspect is whether you need supplemental lighting for them or not. And as I mentioned, with the things that don't have to be in the windowsill for very long, you're putting them in the window pretty late in the season so that the light duration and intensity has increased because of where we are in the season. You may be more successful with that, but you can still end up with some pretty spindly seedlings if the light isn't sufficient. And that's how you'll know if the light is not sufficient. The best bet is to always try to provide some supplemental lighting for starting seeds indoors, not just if you're starting them downstairs in the basement
mm-hmm.
where you know you don't have light, even if you have them in a pretty bright location, even in a sunny southern window, you probably won't have enough light to have really high quality seedlings produced.
Lynn in Wisconsin Dells has a question. Hi, Lynn. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I read somewhere, and I can't figure out which one of my magazines it was in. I looked through all of them, about a tomato that doesn't start to ripen until after it's harvested. So I was wondering if you knew what the name was.
Yeah, no, I don't. I haven't heard of that. Probably something that was developed for the the shipping market to be shipped, you know, so that it can be harvested while it's still underripe. And that's essentially what they have to do with tomatoes that are going to be packed and shipped. They pick them underripe, and then they let them ripen in transit. And some do it better than others in those conditions. But, no, I haven't heard of one that that you can start, you know, as a lay gardener.
Yeah. So I'll keep listening in case somebody else calls.
Yeah, somebody else might know.
Or we may be able to find that on Google.
Yeah, take a look at it. And I was just thinking that last year, I think it was last year, I still had tomatoes from the garden in November.
Wow.
Because I had green ones, you know, I just put them up on the counter.
And
actually it was the year before. Last year, I think it was in late October, but the year before it went into November.
Yeah, you can keep them going for quite a long time if you're careful with them and if they're picked at the right stage. The trick is to be able to pick them when they're mature green.
Yes.
A little bit of, they're full size and maybe a little tiny bit of coloring in them. And then you can store them in that state for quite a while, cool temperatures.
Yeah.
And then as you bring them into warmer and warmer conditions, they will ripen. So, yeah, that's great.
Not
you
as tasty.
To check them. No, not quite as tasty. And then there's always those fried green tomatoes. I hear so many people rave about fried green tomatoes, and I have never successfully cooked fried green tomatoes.
Nor have I. So you and I are together on that one.
Yeah.
Beth in La Crosse has a question. Hi, Beth.
Hi, how are you today?
Great, appreciate the call. What can we do for you?
I have a very small yard. I'm just pulling over because I'm on my Bluetooth here so I can talk to you. I have a very small yard, and I would like to do long raised beds to grow green beans and peas and stuff that could grow up. What would be the minimum width I would need and height?
Well, when you say long raised beds, you mean like a long row to grow things vertically.
Right. It would be. Okay. It would probably be 15 feet long.
Okay.
Like a fence, almost.
Yeah.
And then I can make it as high or as wide. I mean, I do have. I just don't have much yard, so I want to have a little bit of green space where I can walk on my lawn.
So you want to be able to place this right on your lawn as well. And so
it's going to go right.
The only soil they would have to grow the roots into would be in the container itself, in the raised bed itself, right?
Right. It could go right into the ground. I'm going to build it so it has no bottom to it.
Okay.
Then it could go right into the ground. And I just wasn't sure how wide it could, could that be?
Well, probably I would say 2 feet would be ideal.
Yeah.
If you're just going to do a long row of all of these vertical crops like pole beans and cucumbers, and you can even do melons. I did some little cantaloupes up that I trellised and tied them up to a trellis. And then I made little slings out of a netting and tied those strings at the top of the trellis to support them so they didn't get too heavy. But, yeah, if you're going to do that, I'd say, 2 feet would be ideal. I've known people who have grown those crops and tomatoes and everything in, like, window boxes, big window boxes that you can set on the patio. So, 1 foot would probably work. 2 feet would probably work better. They would have more soil to work with. Then, as far as the depth, I think the standard basic raised bed is 10 to 12 inches deep.
Yeah.
And you'll have to add some soil to it every year probably to keep it at that depth. And then they would still have the ground below to go into. You don't really need to go, 2 feet tall or 3 feet tall, as long as, especially if the roots can go down into the ground. But none of those crops are going to get really long root systems. Even tomatoes probably would be okay. But the more soil they have to grow into, they will take advantage of that and go into it.
Yeah, for sure. And the 2 feet, that's easy to get at then, too.
When you were talking about your rosemary, I have to laugh because I had a gentleman come and help me dig up this enormous bush I mean, it was so big we couldn't even put a truck back in. My yard's too small. He hand dug this whole thing out, and I said, I'm going to make it a kitchen garden. I grew, my tomatoes were prolific. My rosemary and thyme and sage are still out in the snow, and I keep clipping up and
oh my gosh.
And I can't believe it. So, because it got too cold and I didn't get to bring them in.
Oh.
And the basil died, of course. I killed it off. But I just went out the other day and cut more rosemary off my bush. I had to move the snow away, and it's beautiful.
Oh, my.
And it's green. It's not dry.
That's wonderful. Well, you know, I like to break it off a little bit if I'm going to spend any time in the bedroom because it smells so good.
Yeah.
It does.
This is like aromatherapy there.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Thanks, Beth.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Pete in South Range. Hi.
Hey, how are you doing?
Great. Appreciate the call. What can we do for you?
Hey, I had a couple questions here. On those raised beds, I raised my cucumbers up there last year about 2 feet, probably 18 inches wide. Put an arched trellis over it and been having trouble trying to get them to grow in there. And the other question was on celery seed. What do we got to do to get that to grow, and will it even work in this area?
Celery.
Back to the cucumbers there, they were wilting and falling off and not getting very big. Stunted growth, but no problem growing them just in the soil, regular ground.
Yeah.
Part of that probably has to do with what soil you used to fill the raised bed. And because they're usually, you know, pretty, like you said, they grow pretty well in ground. So I don't know what else would do that unless it's a variety that succumbed to powdery mildew or anthracnose, which are two big things that affect cucumbers. So that's a possibility. And if you're growing them in close proximity to each other where there's not good air circulation, you may be holding moisture on the leaves longer and get some leaf diseases like powdery mildew and anthracnose. That could be a possibility. But these beds are only 2 feet. They're 2 feet tall, 18 inches wide.
Yep.
And then you've got a hoop system over them to for them to grow up.
Yep.
An 18-inch width. Okay. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to envision that. But
what it is a cattle panel that I had bent across and hoping that it wouldn't have to, you know, bend over. And
Yeah. I would say that it's probably the soil mix that you have in the containers. What did you use?
I used a mix, just regular manure. And then, well, the bottom foot is like a swamp material. I come out of a swamp, I figured that would be good for a base in there. But
I don't think that's the best combination for soil for them to grow in. Okay. It really should be a container soil and not a soil that would be, they sell bagged planting soil, and that's more like the soil that's in the ground. And yet, when you put it into a container, it doesn't function the same way. If there's properties of physics that I don't understand that actually make that soil not work well in containers. So what you're looking for is a container soil, a container medium, a potting soil, something that's really designed to have the drainage and the air space but water holding capacity that's needed for plants growing in containers. So that's what I would recommend doing. I now feel that it's most certainly the soil you're growing them in is causing the problem.
There you go, Pete.
And the other thing you mentioned something else, too.
About celery?
Celery seed, yeah. I don't know what the trick is with celery seed. I've never done it from seed. I did buy some plants this year and tried to grow them. I know people who have grown celery, but I don't know if there is a trick to growing the seeds. I'd follow whatever recommendations there are in the seed packet.
Haven't heard myself either. I tried growing celery once, and it just didn't work out.
There's a lot to it, and I don't know how the growers do it, because it does need to be blanched in order to keep it from getting too much chlorophyll in it and then becoming very, very strong flavored and almost bitter. So you're supposed to tie the stalks together. You're supposed to tie a piece of paper around the stalks as they grow so that you're excluding the light from them. And you tie them together so that they continue to grow upright. You push soil up against them. It's quite an undertaking. We didn't have any great stalks of celery or great I guess, stalks, and then each one of those is a rib, right?
Right, yeah.
We didn't have any great ones, but we had a few ribs on each one that were kind of tasty. So we're going to try it again this year. You got to keep the earwigs out from inside the stalk also. That was a problem, and slugs get at them, so...
I decided to go to the grocery store for my celery.
I guess that's what I've always chosen, too.
It's
always just fun to see how what it takes to grow them. But, you know, it gives me a great respect for our fresh market growers who do produce all of this wonderful produce.
Yeah.
And that we go to the farmers markets and maybe take it for granted a little bit. I remember one time walking into a farmers market and there was a vendor who had an entire table built up into a pyramid of these gorgeous heads of cauliflower. I think I've grown two heads of cauliflower successfully in my whole life. And so I really appreciate what these people are able to do and what it takes to do it.
So support your
local farmers market, too. But
yeah, you're absolutely right. Wonderful comments. And Darlene and Viola has something for us. Darlene?
Yes. Hi there. I would like to know why my rhubarb plants, I have Canada Red and Valentine varieties, and by mid to late July, they just start to wilt and die. The leaves turn brown and yellow, and then they're gone. But then the following spring, they come up just beautifully.
Wow, that is weird. Did they get full sun?
Oh, yes. And I have very rich loamy soil. I use aged cow manure. I get just gorgeous, full, huge plants in spring.
The soil may be too rich for them.
Yeah.
They're not real fussy about soil. They don't need or really like really high fertility soil.
Well, I actually moved them to another location, and they're still doing the same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, they could also have... a disease, a virus, a disease, but I can't think of anything else that would cause that besides the soil conditions, possibly light conditions, and if there were a disease or an insect infestation that was weakening them.
Yeah, but none of that has happened because I get just tons and tons of rhubarb in the spring. They're as healthy as can be.
Huh.
And then, how much of the plant do you harvest? Do you leave a lot of stalks with leaves on them?
I leave about a third to a half.
Okay,
and then when the plants go into to blossom, then I it's time to divide. So I know about all of that.
It's time to divide. You mean you divide?
Well, when they go into seed, when you get the flower stalk. You know, after about 4 or 5 years, then it's time to divide the plant.
Oh, not necessarily.
No.
Because you'll get seed stalks every year, generally, with rhubarb. And you just cut the seed stalk off so you're not expending a lot of energy into the seed stalk and keeping it from the plant. If you're dividing very often, I don't think that that's necessary, and usually a rhubarb plant can stay in the same place for 10 years, 15 years, so you don't need to divide once the seed stalk comes up. And also, if you're harvesting over half of the leaves each year, you may be kind of, weakening it for the rest of the season. It is odd that they come back beautiful every year.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
That's kind of confounding me here.
Yeah, it sure is, Darlene. I don't know either. I thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call very much. We're out of time here, Sharon.
Already?
Yeah, boy, didn't it fly, Sharon?
It does.
Thank you so much. It's always such a pleasure to have you with us, and I look forward to our next visit.
Me too. It was my pleasure to be here today.
Thanks, Sharon. Sharon Morrissey, UW Extension Consumer Horticulture Agent for Milwaukee County. She does a great job, doesn't she? It's always so much fun to have her with us, and she will be back. We'll do it again. Monday, let's take a look ahead here. Physical therapist Bill Boisenault and Lori Tyne Brody stop by, as they do every month. They'll be talking about positions for sleeping and other considerations for taking care of your body when you rest. Monday. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.